Marketplace is supported by Putnam Investments, where performance is driven by original fundamental research on a global scale. This is Putnam Today. Produced in association with the University of Southern California.
Which way will the wind blow? That appears to be a key question for the Gulf Coast oil spill and whether it seeps into the area's fragile wetlands. Another key question, how many hands on deck are required to clean up such an epic mess? From American Public Media, this is Marketplace.
Marketplace is supported by Novo Nordisk, committed to changing diabetes through treatments, partnerships, and education. Defeating diabetes is our passion and our business. And by CSX, whose trains move a ton of freight 436 miles on 1 gallon of fuel to help reduce fuel consumption. CSX, how tomorrow moves.
From the Frank Stanton Studios in Los Angeles, I'm Tess Vigeland in for Kai Rizdahl. Thanks for joining us on this Tuesday. It is the 5th day of May. The Gulf Coast oil spill is prompting calls for tougher safety regulations when it comes to offshore drilling. Some critics say BP and others involved in the project should have taken more precautions. But as Sarah Gardner reports from the Marketplace Sustainability Desk, the decisions around precaution versus risk aren't so simple.
Some critics now point to the lack of a remote-controlled shutoff switch on the Deepwater Horizon rig. It's required in Norway and Brazil, but not in the U.S. It costs $500,000. Transocean, the rig's operator, wouldn't comment today, but a spokesman for the International Association of Drilling Contractors said the backup device hadn't been demonstrated to be effective. The thinking is that lots of leaking oil could block remote signals. Lucian Pularisi is president of the Energy Policy Research Foundation.
None of the companies that we're familiar with deploy new technologies until they are convinced that they want to work, and two, that they're a net gain as a result of doing that.
And figuring net gain isn't so simple, say environmental experts. Cost-benefit analysts call events like this low probability, high risk. Matthew Kochan, an environmental economist at Yale, says some safety decisions make more sense only in hindsight.
So just like it always seems as if it was an obvious decision to have bought flood insurance after a flood, it isn't always obvious that you should have bought flood insurance before the flood occurred.
Kochan says calculating beforehand the full environmental costs of an oil spill are next to impossible, since the extent of damage is clear only years later. One thing that is clear, this oil spill will most likely lead to new regulations. Finding out exactly why this accident happened should help shape those new rules. I'm Sarah Gardner for Marketplace.
A flotilla of boats battled the oil slick today. Defense Secretary Robert Gates approved funding for the deployment of thousands of National Guard troops to help with the response. And BP is recruiting volunteers to clean up the beaches before the oil comes ashore. Hundreds of people have turned up in the last couple of days at a makeshift training center in Waveland, Mississippi. Kate Archer Kent reports most want a paycheck in return.
Wayne Goff has 8 kids, and he's been out of work for a month. He's an instrument technician, and his dream job is working on an offshore rig. The beach cleanup is a good cause, but he's in it for the money.
This company made billions last year in profits, BP. Now, I don't have nothing wrong with volunteering. I've done volunteering during Katrina and other projects around the city, but everyone needs to make a living.
Goff knows that good-paying cleanup jobs are out there, but he'll settle for litter pickup, even if it's just one day of work making $10 an hour.
I'm a skilled guy. I'm not to say I'm above picking up trash, but I'm in it to provide for me and my family.
Goff is going through BP's basic safety training course in the lobby of a strip mall here in Waveland. It's for people who want to clean up beaches and marshland before the oil makes a bigger mess. A BP contractor delivers a PowerPoint presentation. About 40 people have turned out for this afternoon's session. Jim Suchia is BP's community support coordinator for this county. He's trying to keep expectations in check about landing jobs from this basic training.
We don't want to put people in a position where they're gung-ho, they're excited, they're motivated, highly motivated to help. And if we provided training and that didn't use them, that might have a negative effect that we can't measure. So we're caught in that proverbial hard spot.
Several people interviewed said they would be willing to move to wherever temporary jobs might be if opportunities opened up. Trainee Burton Gilbert says it depends on where the oil hits shore.
We might have to go to certain areas where it's worse, you know, just to work at it longer.
BP's Tsuchiya says more than 1,000 people have gone through this training at centers across the Gulf. Wayne Goff, for one, doesn't want oil on his shoreline. But like many others out of work, he wants to see the potential of jobs on the horizon. In Waveland, Mississippi, I'm Kate Archer-Kent for Marketplace.
Just a couple of months ago, Toyota's reputation took what many thought might be a fatal blow. Could the automaker ever survive the sticky pedals and all those recalls? But last month, sales were up 24% over last year. In fact, auto sales overall got a nice boost. The numbers, should we say, were down from March. But given what the industry's gone through the last couple of years, any growth has to be a positive. For some perspective, we turn to Jeremy Anwil, CEO of Edmunds.com. Welcome to the program.
Well, thanks very much for having me.
So where are these gains coming from? Is this still all about incentives?
Well, I think it is. Now, generally, when people are talking about gains, and we saw a lot of this yesterday as the numbers were being announced, they're referring to last year. And this time last year was probably the worst car market in 20 years.
But, you know, I know Toyota is doing quite well, and they've been doing a lot of incentives recently, haven't they?
Well, they stepped them up. Their sales in March took a big increase, but in April they were down about 15% from March. So they did cut back on incentives, and their sales dropped as well. In fact, they're even talking now about making some announcements this week about maybe sweetening the incentive pot a little bit.
But here we are just a few months past the big recall issue with Toyota,
yeah,
where everybody was saying that Toyota, the brand, was no longer what it used to be. And yet we're out buying the cars. What does this say about our consuming behavior if, you know, these low prices can basically override any alarm over safety?
Well, it's an interesting point because a couple months ago in the middle of all this, people could have looked at this and said, well, wow, no one's going to buy a Toyota with
right,
all of this negative publicity. And yet they had a huge month in March, and they basically increased incentives by about $500 roughly. They went up to ballpark $2,500. From about 2,000. So it wasn't a huge amount of money they threw out there. But what's happening is really this. There are a lot of Toyota loyalists out there, people that have owned Toyotas, that have had maybe many Toyotas in the family. They feel very comfortable with the brand, never had a bad experience personally. And if they're in the car market or thinking about buying a car and Toyotas are on sale, then it sounds like a very good deal to them. Where Toyota's taken a hit, and we haven't seen this in the numbers yet because there's so many loyalists out there, would be people that might be thinking of another brand first. And for them, it's been very easy for them just to kind of say, well, you know, I'm aware of all this. I'm just not going to put Toyota back on the shopping list, at least not yet.
Can we, at this point, celebrate the auto sector turnaround? Or are we in a blip and, you know, there will be another turn down once those incentives start going away?
Well, we've had incentives going back for a long time. So it's clearly car sales today are very dependent on incentives. I think consumers in general are pretty wary still. And when there's a good deal out there, consumers will come out and buy. When the deals aren't so good, they pull back. So generally, though, you have to put this into perspective. We've been used to car sales around 16 million a year. And right now, we're still only talking about 11 to 11.5, maybe for this year. So it's still awful. It's just not as awful as it was a year ago. The one good thing, though, is that the car companies have adjusted to this. So we're going to be hearing about some big profits. You know, Ford surprised everybody last week with very robust profits. And it really speaks to, dare I say it, the bright side of a recession. And that is that it gets companies focused on costs. And when they come out of it, they can be very profitable.
Jeremy Anwil is the CEO of Edmunds.com. Thanks so much. It's been nice talking to you.
Anytime. Thank you.
Wall Street had its worst day in 3 months on continuing fears about Europe's debt crisis. We'll have details when we do the numbers. You know, all that money we, the taxpayers, gave the banks last year? Well, ever since then, borrowers have been asking, when can I get some of that back in the form of a loan? A recent survey by the Federal Reserve shows some of the nation's biggest banks have eased their standards for both commercial loans and consumer loans like mortgages. We asked Marketplace's Elisa Roth to find out if that means they're really lending and why it's taken so long.
Let's start with the good news.
There is absolutely more lending than there was.
Quincy Crosby's the market strategist at Prudential Financial. She says loans are going to everyone from big companies to regular people who are refinancing mortgages. But they're only going to the highest rated borrowers. And there's more.
It is still not where we need to be in order to see a major expansion in the economy.
Crosby says it's not all the bank's fault, though. Borrowers are being a bit chicken.
Loan demand, meaning the actual applications for loans, hasn't inched up in any material way because the economy has been bad.
She says the bad economy's created a vicious cycle. People are afraid to borrow, and the banks are afraid to lend. They've tightened restrictions and made it expensive. So expensive that nobody even bothers asking for a loan. Mike England is chief economist at Action Economics. It's a consulting firm. He says another reason banks are still making it tough to borrow is they need to hold on to their cash, because the government's going to want its TARP money back soon.
Cash is needed in order to pay down TARP. You can't pay down TARP with outstanding loans, since the government doesn't want to take them. Loans in exchange, they want currency.
He says banks also want to be ready in case the government imposes new regulations. One rule could force them to hold on to more money, money that in the past they might have lent out. In New York, I'm Elisa Roth for Marketplace.
The euro fell to its lowest level in a year today. The recent news of a debt rescue package for Greece didn't ease fears of financial contagion throughout the eurozone and beyond. Spain was the main focus of today's worries. Rumors swirled that the Spanish government had asked the International Monetary Fund for a $400 billion bailout. The IMF denies it, and the Spanish government said the rumor was, quote, madness. We asked our European correspondent Stephen Beard to try to make some sense of today's mayhem.
The fear of a European government defaulting does on the face of it seem insane. After all, the EU and the IMF have just put together the biggest bailout in history for Europe's most heavily indebted nation, Greece. Howard Wealdon of BGC Brokers says the trouble is the markets aren't buying it.
Markets are simply saying, we don't trust this solution, we don't think it's enough, and quite frankly, we don't trust the Greek government to actually carry out its part of the bargain.
The government in Athens promised deep cuts in public spending. Today, Greek public sector workers delivered their considered response. They launched a 48-hour strike, clashed with riot police and stormed the Acropolis. Analyst Justin Urquhart-Stewart says deficit cutting isn't easy.
It's going to be very painful. And so there'll be tears before bedtime, or more to point, there'll be tear gas before bedtime, as you're going to see further riots and disturbances, not just in Greece, but I suspect elsewhere as well.
Portugal and Spain, two other heavily indebted members of the eurozone, also got a market hammering today. And with the EU appearing powerless to help its members, the euro dropped to its lowest level against the dollar in a year. Treacherous territory, says Wealdon.
This situation is in danger of winding itself out of control.
Greece, Portugal and Spain have one consolation. If this week's election in Britain is inconclusive, as expected, the UK may draw the speculators' fire. Britain and its currency could take a beating instead. In London, this is Stephen Beard for Marketplace.
Did you send an apple to school with your child today? It is National Teacher Day, but for thousands of teachers around the country, it's not an especially happy one. Education Secretary Arne Duncan predicts up to 300,000 teachers and other public school staff could lose their jobs as states make drastic budget cuts. From the Marketplace Education Desk, Amy Scott reports.
Okay, let's touch our toes.
This morning at the Pleasantdale School in West Orange, New Jersey, a group of preschoolers lined up on the gymnasium floor.
All right, let's put our hands behind us. Let's up like a table.
At the end of the school year, their teacher, Alyssa Calabrese, will be out of work.
I applied to like 20 jobs already, haven't heard anything back, so it just shows what crisis we're in.
The West Orange School District lost $6 million in state aid this year. Voters rejected a school budget that would have raised property taxes to make up some of the shortfall. Nick Galanti with the local teachers union says now the district will have to cut even more staff.
We represent about 1,000 people, and I think we're going to lose probably close to 150 staff members.
For students, the cuts mean bigger classes. Programs like band could disappear. Isabel Navoa has a fifth grader at Pleasantdale.
She plays the clarinet, and the thought of her losing her instrumental music for next year is very scary. It's very upsetting.
Navoa is losing something, too, her job as a classroom assistant. Today, the American Federation of Teachers launched a campaign to drum up support for federal aid to save jobs. Critics say the projected layoffs may be exaggerated and that districts need to make cuts. Liam Julian is a fellow at the Hoover Institution. He says teacher hiring has far outpaced growth in enrollment.
So you're talking about class sizes getting a lot smaller with no real appreciable gains in the educational outcomes of students.
Julian says districts should focus on hiring better teachers and ending policies that push young, non-tenured teachers out the door first, like Pleasantdale's Alyssa Calabrese. After almost 3 years at the school, she was due for tenure in September. In West Orange, New Jersey, I'm Amy Scott for Marketplace.
Coming up, how parking meter prices affect human behavior.
If you make a price that's a little bit closer to what the demand is, then you'll see people share better.
But first, let's do the numbers. Those concerns we mentioned about Greece and Spain sent markets sliding all over the world today. The Dow plunged 2%, 225 points to 10,926. The Nasdaq barreled down nearly 3%, 74 points to finish at 2424. And the S&P 500 sank 2.3%, 28 points, ending at 1173. Financial shares took a dive after Treasury Secretary Tim Geithner made a case to lawmakers for taxing banks. Both Bank of America and Wells Fargo crumbled 2.75%. J.P. Morgan withdrew 2.5%. Energy companies dribbled lower as BP struggled to contain its oil leak. ConocoPhillips drained more than 2.75%. Exxon bled out 2%, and Chevron spilled 2.5%. Bonds rose. The yield on the 10-year T-note fell to 3.6%. And you are listening to Marketplace.
Marketplace is supported by Constant Contact, working to help small businesses understand what social media can do for them. Learn more at constantcontact.com/social media. And by Mass Mutual, a mutual life insurance company owned by its members and policyholders. Learn more at massmutual.com/mutuality. Let us give you the business 24 hours a day. Just tap marketplace.org into your mobile phone for the latest financial news and reports from around the globe on how the economy is affecting our lives.
From the Marketplace Statebook, here's a look at events coming up Wednesday. The Mortgage Bankers Association will release data on mortgage applications for the week ending May 2nd. The private data firm ADP plans to publish its numbers on national employment for April. And the World Economic Forum on Africa will convene in Tanzania. I'm Kevin Ferguson.
This is Marketplace from American Public Media. I'm Tess Vigeland in for Kai Rizdal. We talked earlier about how big banks may, just may, be opening the tap a little wider on the flow of loans to consumers and businesses. But that doesn't mean the banking system is healthy yet. So far this year, 64 banks have failed, meaning the Federal Deposit Insurance Corporation has to come in and clean up. The FDIC is looking for new ways to recoup that money spent on those efforts, and the agency thinks it may have found one new solution in an Ohio courtroom. Dan Bobkoff of WCPN in Cleveland explains.
When AmTrust Bank in Cleveland failed in December,
the FDIC's insurance fund took a $2 billion hit. Bill Monick of Case Western Reserve University says the FDIC is getting more aggressive because of its own money problems.
What it's looking for is every time it has to go in and rescue a bank, it's looking to recover money at any possible opportunity.
If it prevails in a Cleveland bankruptcy court, the FDIC might have another way to get more money out of the parent companies of failed banks. It's going after AmTrust's former parent, which now calls itself AmFin, arguing it violated a 2008 order to keep the bank solvent. But an order is different from the formal commitments other banks have made to the government. The FDIC wants the court to treat them the same. Attorney Joe Hutchinson represents the FDIC.
The basic position of the FDIC is that a commitment was made by the holding company, the parent company of AmTrust Bank.
But AmFin says it never committed to anything. It had to deal with problems in its other businesses. What's at stake? In this case, at least $518 million. That's how much it would have taken to keep AmTrust Bank alive. The FDIC wants AmFin to pay up. That could leave other creditors with nothing. Chris Meyer is a lawyer for AmFin. He says it's unlikely its assets, which include a lot of Florida real estate, are even worth enough to cover what the FDIC wants.
If the FDIC was the first and foremost creditor for an amount in excess of $500 million, it may make sense for us to simply to hand them the keys, so to speak, and liquidate the business.
The FDIC's court filings make no secret that it sees this case as about far more than one failed bank in Ohio. It says the ruling will have a big effect on its authority to hold bank holding companies accountable. And with roughly 700 institutions on its problem list, banking expert Bill Monick says the agency is trying to arm itself for more fights.
The FDIC may be trying to set a new precedent here in anticipation of the next 100 and 150 bank failures that are coming its way.
In Cleveland, I'm Dan Bobkoff for Marketplace.
Yesterday, the Atlanta City Council voluntarily gave up about $400,000 of potential revenue. Not something you hear a lot in these austere days of government budget cutting. They voted to suspend parking meter enforcement for 30 days because residents complained about the aggressive tactics of a private company that runs the meters. But COIN isn't the only benefit meters bring to cities and the businesses that line their streets. From WNYC in New York, Andrea Bernstein has more.
I'm walking on 6th Avenue in Greenwich Village, a place famous for limited parking. About a year ago, the City Department of Transportation decided to do an experiment here. They started charging more for parking during peak periods. Dr. Rachel Weinberger is a professor at the University of Pennsylvania and author of a recent study on parking. She says one way to get more parking spots is to get people to leave faster.
Which means make it more available for more people to use. And if you make a price that's a little bit closer to what the demand is, then you'll see people share better.
On the street, it costs $2 an hour at a meter, $3 an hour during peak periods. But it costs $17 an hour to park in a garage, so it's hard to believe that an extra dollar an hour for a meter can be much of a disincentive. But I notice several open spots as we walk. I'm shocked.
I was a little shocked myself.
But Weinberger adds,
people are actually quite price sensitive to very small increments in price. This can be a very effective tool for affecting different kinds of behavioral changes in how people transport themselves around.
As we're walking, I see a man putting money into a machine to pay for parking.
Hi, how are you?
Mechanic Victor Duran says he drove down from his home in Upper Manhattan to shop. Finding parking, he says, was a breeze.
Is that worth it to you?
No. It's too much.
So would you rather drive around and look for a spot, or would you rather pay the dollar?
It's better pay the dollar.
Weinberger says no one likes paying for parking, but paying can influence behavior. When spots are more expensive, they open up more quickly. Drivers circle less. Congestion eases. Pollution drops. Paying for parking can push people to carpool or take transit. But making parking more expensive isn't exactly popular. Greg Ninyasov runs a hair salon. He says the new fees are discouraging his customers.
Nobody wants to park because everybody's complaining because it's too much money. All my clients, they're like complaining why it's so much.
But the city liked the results of its Manhattan experiment. Last fall, it launched another pilot in Brooklyn. Hardware store owner Victor Shabbat is pleased with the results there.
Well, make it easy for a customer. This way people park and they move on and they, you know, what happened is much better.
Business owners in Pasadena, California also came to like the idea of collecting all those quarters. Steve Mulhan heads up the shopping district. To get the local merchants to embrace the plan, he said, a promise was made. The parking revenue would go right back into the streets.
The city on a normal basis would sweep streets about once a quarter.
But now?
We sweep every street, every alleyway, every night.
Mulheim says without the parking money, the district faced cutbacks in maintenance.
It really makes a big difference to even our consumer base when they know that that money isn't just going into, you know, a big bottomless pit somewhere.
Mulheim acknowledges there are still unhappy drivers. But as more cities face drastic cutbacks, parking revenue looks sweeter and sweeter. Jeanette Sadikhan is New York City's transportation commissioner. At a recent conference, she had this to say.
I think, in a way, it's going to, you know, in 50 years, people are going to think we were insane to give free space to parking, you know, on city streets because it's such a valuable resource.
Arrayed around the table were transportation officials from Houston, Philadelphia, Washington, and elsewhere. Their heads were nodding up and down vigorously in agreement. In New York, I'm Andrea Bernstein for Marketplace.
Marketplace is supported by Putnam Investments, recognizing the value of a well-diversified college savings plan. This is Putnam Today. Additional support from the University of Southern California's Annenberg School for Communication and Journalism.
And this final note, Australians were apparently napping in the outback during the U.S. housing market bubble and bust. That country's Bureau of Statistics reported today that home prices in Sydney are up 20% over a year ago. In Melbourne, they jumped almost 30%. That news came a day after Australia's Treasury Secretary said he believed commodity boom Mark II had begun. Prices for iron and coal are also rising at the fastest pace on record. Crikey, mates. Take a lesson, would you? And that is Marketplace from American Public Media. Today, the Dow dropped 2%, 224 points. The NASDAQ gave back nearly 3%, 74 points. And the S&P 500 sank 2.75%, 32 points. Thanks to Jennifer Collins and Ethan Lindsay on our Morning Report crew. The Marketplace Morning Report is produced by Rod Abid. Tune in tomorrow to the Marketplace Morning Report for the latest in business and economic news. Next time on this program, following the money and babies in Chinese adoptions.
If the international adoption program was not there, these children probably would not have ended up in the orphanage to begin with.
I'm Tess Vigeland. Hope you can join us for that tomorrow.
American Public Media.
The world can be a confusing place for kids, and finding the words to explain it all can be tricky, too. Introducing Million Bazillion, a Webby-winning podcast from Marketplace that takes your kids on exciting adventures to answer the awkward and complex questions they have about money. Each week, we tackle hard-hitting inquiries from kid listeners like,
what is a college account and how does it work?
I want to know what unions are and what they are for.
Why does the U.S. have so much gold in Fort Knox and what do they use it for?
Help your kids understand how money fits into the world around us. Listen to Million Bazillion wherever you get your podcasts.